If you look at the images that the society creates, that it makes money from, that encourages it to continue to turn out these kind of violent, imaginary, delusional stories in movies and television and what have you. It's based on the fact that enough people are excited by it and buy into it and are stimulated by it, and that it reaches the unconscious. It reaches the reptilian brain. Mm-hmm. It encourages the reptilian brain to be what it is. And that to me is a fallacy of capitalism.
But it seems to me that it's propaganda for the world, for the war culture. That's the way I look at it. Well, it's truly just a lot of propaganda.
Look, it's a mystery and a topic that I certainly can't talk about tonight. But at the same time, a lot of what Firesign did in its career of broadcasting and recording and all the rest was an attempt to expose this particular reality
sure.
to people, and to show them that you individually that you didn't have to buy into it. You can enjoy it, but it doesn't have to destroy your brain or your spirit or your conscience or your life. You can look at it and laugh at it, basically. If you can laugh at it, it frees you from it. You can enjoy it, but you have to laugh at it. You have to say, wow, that was trippy.
Don't look back.
Don't look back.
Don't look back. Yes, it's time again to play Don't Look Back, the game of futures shock that gets them from behind and forces them to face the answer. And tonight, from the heart of Milltown, Manhattan, we're going to ask you, Philip Baines Austin, formerly of Denver, Colorado, to
face the answer.
And just remember, if you can, don't look back.
Yes. And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Larry Lott.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. And hi, Phil.
Hi, Larry.
How are you feeling tonight?
Oh, gee, just really a little scared.
Good. Do you think that you can not look back and still face the answer?
Well, I guess so. Yeah.
You don't know, though, do you?
No, I don't know.
Well, we're going to find out. Okay, let's get on with the mystery riddle, Ken.
Okay.
Right, Larry. All right, Philip Baines Austin of Fort Worth, Florida, riddle me this.
Yeah?
Why is a cow?
What?
But, oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry,
Phil, or should I say I'm glad? The correct answer is, to why is a cow? Because a vest has no sleeves.
but that's
you
ridiculous.
Couldn't beat the rap. You couldn't face the answer. And now it's time to listen to a voice from the past.
But remember, Phil, don't look back.
Child's thought. Where is the child's place among the silent shifting dunes? He sits among them playful, smiling, sifts the grains through fingers, plying for the hidden anchored pattern. Root of that which has not root, and base of that whose fundamental pours to finite dunes of infinite and viewless sand.
Sound familiar, Phil?
No, where did you get that?
But
where did you get that?
We're
from?
Not through yet.
Oh, no.
Now! Now, Philip Baines Austin. Answer me this.
Yeah?
Did you ever steal a car? Even when you were a little boy?
Well, gee whiz, I don't. Yeah.
Yes, you did, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Okay, do you want to tell me anything more about it?
No.
Okay, now.
Yeah, Joe, I know what you mean. This oil beer goes through you like a hot car, see? Yeah, speaking of which, what kind of touring car you like to steal when you're doing a...
Answer me this.
Now, answer me this. Did you ever know anyone named Slugger?
yes, I did.
Want to tell us a little bit about Slugger?
Yes. Well, Slugger was a boxer that I knew, that I used to work out with. Many years ago in the Frog Gym in Fresno, California.
Yeah, don't be nervous now. You're doing just fine. Okay.
And,
Phil.
Yeah?
Phil, I want you to answer me this one question.
Yes.
Okay. Explain to me, because you love me, how to make and play poo sticks.
Yes. This is really good, man. Poo sticks is where you get a bridge with a river running under it, and you all the players have different sticks, you dig, that they can recognize what the sticks are, what kind it is. And then you get on one side of the bridge, right? And you drop the sticks in the water, and then you run over to the other side of the bridge, and the stick that comes through first wins. It's one of the finest non-competitive games I know.
Okay, now it's my turn, Phil. Answer me this. What part did you play in The Chinese Bear and the Hindu Cat?
I don't remember, Larry. I don't even remember that at all.
What part did your sister play?
What? No, I don't remember that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Right.
Did you
Can't
ever
face
have a
that
doll
one.
Or a stuffed animal?
Yeah. I had a stuffed animal at one time. I think it was a bear. Yes, I had a bear.
What about Eeyore?
Eeyore. I don't remember.
You can't face
this.
That, can you, Phil?
No,
okay,
no.
Let's go on.
Oh, yes, I can face anything. You're just lying to me.
All right, that's all right. Don't
you
be
don't
nervous.
Remember any of this stuff any better than I do.
No, that's
okay,
all right.
Phil. Did you ever have a wake?
A what?
A wake because you lost an election.
I don't remember that.
Did you ever give anyone a birthday present made from a barrel stave?
I can't remember that.
What
it
about
has
the,
a vague familiar.
Does the number 17 have anything to do with that?
No, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I mean,
ahead.
I should.
Were you ever caught petting in a tree at a Senate banquet?
Yes.
They remember
face
that.
The answer. You remember that?
Yes, that was it.
And tell me, Phil.
Yes.
What did you do under the blanket during the movie?
Under the blanket. Mm-hmm. That's very funny. I was just thinking about that the other day.
Yeah, we noticed under the blanket.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there anything any more of this?
Well, Phil, you're doing just wonderful now. Yes. Do you want to rest for a while or shall we go on?
I'd like to go
Let's
to sleep,
go on.
I think.
Okay, you know, it gets tougher, and I'll bet you're having a hard time trying not to look back. But remember, it's all in fun, okay?
Yeah.
Here's a big one, Phil. You better lie down. What did Ginny write in the note she left in your locker?
Was it really to confuse me?
What was it really your fault that she was ill?
Are you trying to?
Okay.
No. Now let me explain that one.
Okay.
That one I can explain. Yeah. I didn't have anything to do with her having
mononucleosis.
Cancer, I think. No, I didn't give her cancer.
Mononucleosis.
She got the cancer all by the cancer came in the mail.
Can't
I didn't have anything to do with it. I didn't get anywhere near the mailbox.
Okay, Phil.
Or anything else, and I didn't cause any of that.
Phil Austin passed away of numerous forms of cancer after fighting the courageous battle and all of that.
You've suffered enough, Phil. Suffered enough.
Find me a sober Republican and you'll be made for life. I'd always assumed, of course, that I had been made for life, and if I hadn't, it would have been over long ago. But then again, I hate metaphysics.
So, Mystery Voice, read from the pages of the past, and let's find out who has forced Phil to face the answer.
If there was one thing that gave a little town with a stupid name, Beaver Teeth, something to be legitimately proud of, it was the exploits of Jim Rook. Although he had toiled in the grip of the midnight, still he was a Beaver Teeth hero, and everybody in Midden knew it. He had been everything, all state, all conference, all prep, all America at Beaver Teeth High School. He was the greatest alumnus of Beaver Teeth University College ever. And most important, he was the single person who had dragged Drifter Ball up out of the muck of professional wrestling or carnivals. He was the real thing, that's who he was. All sports, all letters, all honors, all everything.
Philip Austin. Skis. I have no embarrassing moment. I am perfectly well adjusted, admitted Phil Austin, this week's wow warrior.
His skill in swimming has won him a position in the FHS swim team for the last 3 years.
Philip, as he is called by his associates, dislikes recommendation, Texas prejudices, materialists, nasty owlet editors, and especially good fellows.
This 5'10" greenish-eyed individual has membership in CSF, Purple and Gold, Senate, the Student Court, and the Backslapping Club.
Phil, who plans to become a lawyer in the future, revealed his ambition in life is to be perfect. He likes all Smiling Babbitts, Percy Bysshe, Howard Hansen, J.S. Bach, and turtles.
Gervais heads his list of entertainment favorites. Others include actor Will Kemp, actress Julie Harris, singer Willie Loman, and modern jazz quartet Fontessa.
Phil's friends include all sane people, Gloria, Annette, and Bubbles.
Yes, Phil, you've been done in by your good friend, Annette! You're a wonderful sport. You didn't turn into a pillar of salt. And Jimmy, tell him what he's won.
Well, you've won a dinner in Chinatown at the Hung Well restaurant for you, your wife, your dog, and anybody else you want to bring along. You've also won a complete broken set of color bars for the home, leveled mountain skis for that open winter season, a frog suit, spike weeds, veined weeds, some grapes, and some soiled heat.
So be sure to listen again next week to Face the Answer when we may ask you that embarrassing question, and you may hear those weird little voices warning you.
Don't look back.
Don't look back.
Don't look back.
Like when I went to summer camp once, they wouldn't let me pull KP. They wouldn't let me do it because my hair was too long, and it was dirty.
Gets caught in the drains.
You get into interesting situations like that, and cause a lot of ruckus, and feel somehow as if you're doing something for the revolution.
Porcupines at the university. And now the purple dusk of twilight time steals across the meadows of my heart, the dean said. His pretty wife, Paula, extended her long, graceful hands full of Negronis. A scout burst into the room, through the door.
Porcupines, he shouted.
Porcupines what? The dean asked.
Thousands and thousands of them, 3 miles down the road and coming fast.
Maybe they won't enroll, the dean said. Maybe they're just passing through. You can't be sure, his wife said. How do they look? He asked the scout, who was pulling porcupine quills out of his ankles.
Well, you know, like porcupines.
Are you going to bust them? Pamela asked. I'm tired of busting people, the dean said. They're not people, Paula pointed out.
De bustibus non est disputatandum, the scout said.
I suppose I'll have to do something, the dean said.
Meanwhile, the porcupine wrangler was wrangling the porcupines across the dusty and overbuilt west. Dust clouds, yips, the lowing of porcupines. Get along there, little porcupines. And when I reach the great porcupine canneries of the east, I will be rich, the wrangler reflected. I will sit on the front porch of the Muehlbach Hotel in New York City and smoke me a big cigar. Then the fancy women.
Let's say I'm frightened and alone, and that I have the face of an angel and the body of someone that angels have to turn their faces away from on the street in order that they might begin quickly to pray.
All right, you porcupines, step up to that yellow line.
There was no yellow line. This was just an expression the wrangler used to keep the porcupines moving. He had heard it in the army. The damn fool porcupines didn't know the difference.
The wrangler ambled along reading the ads in a copy of Song Hits magazine. Play harmonica in 5 mins, and so forth. The porcupines scuffled along, making their little hops. There were 4,000 or 5,000 in the herd. Nobody had counted exactly.
An assistant wrangler rode in front of the outskirts of the herd. He, too, had a copy of Song Hits magazine in his hip pocket. He looked at the head wrangler's arm, which had a lot of little holes in it.
Hey, Griswold?
Yeah?
How'd you get all them little holes in your arm?
You ever tried to slap a brand on a porcupine?
Probably the fancy women will be covered with low-cut dresses and cheap perfume, the wrangler thought.
She got up slowly then, as if to look for something. She had on red spike heels, and her stacked body was silhouetted right through the thin dress with the painted parrots on it, and the light from the evil moon streaming through the big windows, through which I could see the long lines of rollers breaking on the beach. I grabbed her, and she grabbed me, and before you knew it, her tongue was finding places in me that my own saliva had abandoned years ago. Her lithe body seemed a cup to me, and we fell to the expensive tongue and groove and tore at each other's clothes.
Probably there'll be hundreds of them, hundreds and hundreds, all after my medicine bundle containing my gold and my lucky drill bit. But if they try to rush me, I will pull my guitar and sing them a song of prairie virility.
Porcupines at the university, the dean's wife said. Well, why not?
We don't have facilities for 4,000 or 5,000 porcupines, the dean said. I can't get a dial tone.
They could take alternate lifestyles, Paula said. We've already got too many people in alternate lifestyles, the dean said, putting down the telephone. Out of hell with it, I'll bust them myself, single-handed. Lie.
You'll get hurt.
Nonsense. They're only porcupines. I better wear my own clothes.
Bag of dirty shirts in the closet, Paula said.
The dean went into the closet. Bags and bags of dirty shirts. Why doesn't she ever take these shirts to the laundry?
Griswold, the wrangler,
wrote a new song in the saddle. Fancy woman, how come you don't do right? I'd a rap you in the mouth for the way you acted in the porte cochere of the Trinity River Consolidated General High last Friday night.
And the next thing you know, I was flat on my back, 2 drinks in each hand. I was under attack from a beautiful girl who held on to me tight. I grabbed my wallet, said, man, don't fight, you paid your money, you've got all night to wrestle a nude live stewardess in flight. Well, I opened them wide and she sure was right. What she had on didn't keep out no light. She was nude as a proud bird, oh, wearing a cute little hat.
I will sit back and watch it climb in the charts, he said to himself, as recorded by Merle Travis. First it will be a bell ringer, then top 40, finally a golden oldie. All right, you porcupines, get along. The herd was moving down a 12-lane trail of silky smooth concrete. Signs along the trail said things like, next exit 5 meh, and radar in use. Hey, Griswold, some of them motorists behind us is getting awful edgy. I'm running this here porcupine drive, Griswold said, and I say we better get them off the road. The herd was turned onto a broad field of green grass. Green grass with white lime lines on it at 10-yard intervals. The Ed Sullivan Show, the wrangler thought. Well, Ed, how I come to write this song, I was on a porcupine drive. The last of the great porcupine drives, you might say. We had 4,000 or 5,000 head. We'd fatted up along the Tuscarora, and we was heading for New York City. The dean loaded a gleaming Gatling gun capable of delivering 360 rounds a minute. The Gatling gun sat in a mule-drawn wagon, and it was covered with an old piece of canvas. Formerly, it had sat on a concrete slab in front of the ROTC building. First, the dean said to himself, all they see is this funky old wagon pulled up by this busted-up old mule. Then I whip off the canvas. There stands the gleaming Gatling gun, capable of delivering 360 rounds a minute. My hand resting lightly, confidently on the crank. They shall not pass, I say. Il ne passeront pas. Then the porcupine hide begins to fly.
I wonder if these rounds are still good.
The gigantic Gatling gun loomed over the herd like an immense piece of bad news. Hey, Griswold!
What?
He's got a gun!
I see it, Griswold said. You think I'm blind?
What are we gonna do?
How about vamoosing? But the herd! Them little porcupines can take care of their own selves, Griswold said. God darn, I guess we better parley. He got up off the grass where he had been stretched full length and walked toward the wagon. What say, partner?
Look, the dean said, you can't enroll these porcupines. It's out of the question.
That's so.
It's out of the question, the dean repeated.
We've had a lot of trouble around here. The cops won't even speak to me. We can't take any more trouble.
The dean glanced at the herd. It's a mighty handsome herd you have there.
Kind of you, Griswold said. It's a mighty handsome mule you got.
They both gazed at the dean's terrible-looking mule. Griswold wiped his neck with a red bandana.
don't want no porcupines over to your place, is that it?
That's it.
Well, we don't go where we ain't wanted, the wrangler said. No call to throw down on us with that machine there.
The dean looked embarrassed.
You don't know Mr. Ed Sullivan, do you? Griswold asked. He lives around here somewheres, don't he?
I haven't had the pleasure, the dean said. He thought for a moment. I know a booker in Vegas, though. He was one of our people. He was a grad student in comparative religion.
Maybe we can do a deal, the wrangler said. Which way is New York City?
Well, the dean's wife asked, what were their demands? I'll tell you in a minute, the dean said. My mule is double parked.
The herd turned onto the Cross Bronx Expressway. People looking out of their cars saw thousands and thousands of porcupines. The porcupines looked like badly engineered vacuum cleaner attachments. Vegas, the wrangler was thinking. 10 weeks at Caesar's Palace at a sock, 15 G's a week.
I'm glad y'all came out here to, where are we today? Las Vegas, to the Caesar's Chalice. And I'm Jody Powell, you know me. And I'm sorry about a spill. I noticed I spilled some of your grasshopper on you, miss.
Yes,
I'm sorry about that.
Cute,
the president will be out here in just a minute. Here comes now President Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
Questions, Jimmy. Now open to questions from the floor. Mr. Carter, President.
Mr. President, Arnold Chuzzworth here from the Granada Hills Post-Dispatch.
Yes, Arnold.
On the international human rights scene, Mr. President, you oppose America's withdrawal from the 1980 Moscow Olympics as a protest to the conviction and the jailing of Sharansky and a number of other dissidents. Have you changed your mind?
Very glad you asked that. The reason that I'm supporting the position of remaining in the Moscow Olympics is that I believe we must give the dissidents themselves a chance to participate in the Olympics, since the Russians are placing such terrible hurdles in front of the various dissident groups that are trying to leave the country. I believe that the dissidents who have escaped should be allowed to participate in a new high hurdles event, and that's why
no more pictures, please. I'm sorry. I understand that the no more pictures, please. We understand that the sound of the shutters is disturbing the recording equipment.
Next question.
I'm Sidney Glib of the Bakersfield Sun. Staying with this Russian question, we know there are some pretty high-level disarmament negotiations going on behind the scenes with Brezhnev, and that your national security advisor, Brzezinski, is factoring heavily, so to speak.
What did he say?
Sir, what's his strategy?
Well, I'm going to let Mr. Brzezinski, who's here today at Caesar's Chalice, just got him away from the blackjack table, I'm going to let him speak for himself about this question.
I was playing Russian roulette, actually.
The Ballad of the Last Drive. Leroy Griswold singing his smash single, The Ballad of the Last Drive. Get along there, little porcupines! The citizens in their cars looked at the porcupines, thinking, what is wonderful? Are these porcupines wonderful? Are they significant? Are they what I need?
When he was very much younger than he is today, in the beautiful and mysterious city of San Francisco, two women, a brunette one and a blonde one, were momentarily kind to Ballinger at a time when he needed kindnesses of one sort or another, for the shaping of a life which had but barely commenced, and which was not without considerable confusion, as is the case with most young lives. In this city of San Francisco, because of these real women, enough happened, although it seemed very little at the time, to produce the first chiseling away at the rough marble of a life among women that years later would come to him to seem like not such a bad life after all. Ballinger was barely 20 in those days, the now obscured and nearly forgotten early 1960s. He had gone away from the town and family in which he had grown. He had been lucky enough to find barely affordable lodgings in a big old comfortable Victorian house overlooking California Street, just below the quiet and wealthy charm of Pacific Heights, and just above the noisy bustle of the burgeoning district around Steiner Street, which was colorful, but not exactly flush with cash. In this improved place, that is, it was not out in the great, flat, maligned San Joaquin Valley of Central California, he had set himself a superior distance from his country home. The life of the city boiled around him. The traffic, more than he had ever seen, whizzed in double file up and down the terrifyingly steep hills. Towers and castles hung from the sheer rocks. He could hear from his window the faint singings of a Baptist choir, which was unfortunately seldom in tune, and which seemed, regardless of the members' colors, they were, like the city itself, mixed, to be devoid of what was just then beginning to be called soul. Still, Ballinger had thought to himself, still this was just fine. He could hear the clanging of the antique bells on the cable cars as they clattered up California Street toward the great palace hotels of the town. In what he came to call the House of Little Men, he had the entire front half of the third story above the garage. The House of Little Men itself was a comfortable old place that might have been a faraway model for the sheltering domicile that Louisa May Alcott depicted so vividly in her book called Little Men. Like that 19th-century New England nest, it was filled with an odd collection of male humans who, like orphan boys, lived with each other and all too often only for each other, because there were no real women in their pathetic and lonely lives. In Alcott's story, there presides over the orphans the dear woman called Jo, who is mother to them all. In San Francisco, in the House of Little Men, confronted by spook in Ballinger's early life, there were two women, the blonde bombshell, who was not motherly at all, but entirely mystical, and the dark actress, who, while earnest and wild, was full of only conventional wisdom. Ballinger's apartment in the House of Little Men consisted of what must have been in earlier days a large dining room with an alcove for serving. In this alcove, behind screens, he slept, finally far away from colleges and families, alone at last, a young man with two jobs and the world ahead of him. His housemates, the orphan boys, were primarily Japanese nationals, young men who had been assigned to the newly established San Francisco office of the venerable firm called Japan Airlines. In fact, that was how he had come to live in this place, because he'd found a paying job working nights for Japan Airlines down on Union Square. It was a good job because it allowed him to continue being an actor of sorts in the play King Lear by William Shakespeare, wherein he played many small parts over the course of an evening as a very junior and unpaid member of a prestigious company inhabiting a dark old theater down on Geary Street. Bellinger was at an age where the dilemmas of King Lear were beginning to make some sense to him. Not the dilemma of age, certainly, but the problems of a man's relations with women. Lear's problems, although they are legion, seemed to Bellinger, when you boiled everything down, to amount to only one thing. King Lear runs afoul of trying to control women. The fact that the women in question are his daughters was neither here nor there to Ballinger's way of thinking. Women were women when it came to problems. In this particular production of King Lear, the youngest of Lear's daughters was played by the dark actress, a lovely woman who was destined to eventually become the star of a movie so important that it would come to be beloved by his entire generation. In fact, it would come to largely represent that generation as it cut its huge swath through time in America. She was, of course, as beautiful as actresses must be, and she was young as actresses must once be, and she was haughty and down to earth at the same time. She was the daughter of Lear's dreams. She was everything confusing and wonderful in Ballinger's dreams.
Where did you go, Mrs. Robinson?
Well, my husband stole home, so where was I supposed to go?
You know, I used to do Army Reserve radio programs. Did I ever talk about this on the air before?
I don't know. Does it make any difference?
Bear my horrible soul to the... I used to do a show on KIEV Sunday mornings.
Kiev.
Kiev Radio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. With Yuri Gagarin.
It was a country and western radio show. Did you ever hear my show?
Kiev.
Marine Private Vaughn Philkins. You never heard. It was called something like Country and Western. Country and. Your Army Reserve Country and Western Show or something like that. It was something really kind of inspired like that. And we played Ferlin Husky, and this old sergeant I had in the Army, named Sergeant Louis Illuminato, who was indeed an enlightened man, as far as I've been able to determine. He was like a Zen monk, man. The cat was just incredible. He was so spaced, and he was my sergeant, and he thought that I was his son. My hair kept getting longer and longer, and I kept getting in more and more trouble with the Army. But Sergeant Louis Illuminato still considered me basically his son. It never made any difference to him what I did. He liked me because I did the country and western show.
That's a good reason to like somebody.
That was the whole story of my Army career. I was crazier than hell, man. But those old crazy drunken Army sergeants, I always got along really good with those guys.
Well, Duckman, an old thing, really, I think the first record I ever made, and it's on Decca, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, by the Buddies.
Does Decca even exist anymore, in fact?
MCA owns the Decca stuff, so...
Well, anyway, yeah, the Buddy. Well, the record producer named us afterwards. They told us that we were the Buddies. We had no idea we were the Buddies when we were doing it. And I was in the Army at the time, and two guys, we were working in what was loosely known as psychological warfare, which meant that we were insane and in the Army at the same time. And this was like middle 60s, and somehow, because we would be on this radio, so our job was conducting radio broadcasts to imaginary Vietnamese in San Pedro, California.
Uh-huh.
We invented Duckman because my friend Lee Bernardi could do a duck voice.
Right.
And no one else could. So there you go.
I mean, that's fantastic.
On such thin reeds is great art built, or our great art is built.
The Adventures of Duckman and Ganders. Savior of the downtrodden, protector of the poor, defender of right-thinking, Duckman, with his inseparable companion and guide, Ganders, nightly speeds on his rounds through Blossom City, fighting crime, blasphemy, and bad people.
When you were recording, I noticed that you were associated at one time with Gary Usher, and then for a while with Cyrus Farjar. Did those guys bring much to the table? What kind of... I mean, Gary produced the Birds, for God's sakes, you know?
So I guess Gary was a bizarre character. Gary was the reason that the Firesign Theater exists in a way. I met Gary because I forget why. Oh, I know. Some guys I met in the Army, we did a record with Decca Records called Duckman, Parts 1 and Part 2. Gary was the producer.
Ah.
And that's how we met. That's how he knew to call me when he heard the Firesign Theater on the radio, and called me up and said, "Hey, let's make a record." And Peter and I and he had a meeting, and we decided that we were going to do a record with something called the Parasite Theater, which we just sort of recently invented. And Gary went along with it, and the record label went along with it, and thus history is made.
Phil Austin, the Firesign Theater was compared to rock groups in the 60s. Did that affect the kind of airplay you got on FM radio stations?
We were aware of the fact that there was a form there that could be played with, but had it not been for the rock and roll business just starting and being in the state it was in when we hit Columbia Records in the late 60s, and the fact that the guys who... We're in charge of the music division, essentially gave the rock and roll producers their head for a few years and did not oversee them carefully, and we came in under the rock and roll music aegis. That's two or three pieces of good luck right there. And then when the records were put out, suddenly there was this thing called FM that used to be reserved only for dogfights and obscure Mexican music and polkas or something like that, and communists on the FM and a few public radio stations, in our case KPFK, which is where we worked here in Los Angeles. And FM suddenly was playing all the best rock and roll music and all the best of what was then thought of to be a kind of alternate culture, and which now has in fact moved into the White House and is the culture. And there we were, oddly enough. You could use up vast amounts of time. Disc jockeys could put on one of our records and be assured that they could go to the bathroom with no one really bothering them for a while.
And now I'm going to finish my set with one for the boys on pod at Luther Dorm. It's White Brains on Toast. Remember their concert at the Donut Dome? Well, I still can't hear anything, but I've got to play this one again. It's Eat or Be Eaten.
Gotta talk to you.
Okay, let me just turn the monitor down.
I was part of the Laurel Canyon crowd, the Ladies of the Canyon scene.
If we're gonna do this crazy thing, let's do it right. You got to call me Apricot Brown.
Huh? Oh, Apricot.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm, who am I?
Barbara Q. Ribs.
Ribs. Oh, that's yeah, right. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I guess we're ready. With these balloons under our jerseys, I think we look like real roller maidens.
Well, you don't, not with that eyelash hanging down over your nose.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, come on, help me, will you? Oh, come on, you're shaking. Don't act so scared.
Well, this isn't acting. This is real. That Johnny Fresno mob scares me to death.
Oh, now get a hold of yourself. We've got to save the girls.
Yeah, save them for a rainy day.
No. Save them from themselves. Now come on, and now don't open your mouth. This is the biggest social event of the year, and try to think like a girl.
I am trying to think like a girl, but all I keep thinking of is girls.
Oh, yeah, just like in that prurient dream.
That's funny, old pal, and you should say that, because in that makeup and that outfit, you look like somebody in my dream.
Oh, don't you get fresh. Yeah. Oh, look out. Here comes someone. This is it. Let's go.
Oh, caramba, holy mother, look out for me.
Come on.
And what I remember most about, I guess to lump it all into one thing, is that everything about the Firesign Theater in those days, as perhaps in these days, has to do with finding a common denominator and then trying to find some entertaining way of writing that common denominator down, of actually fixing it in time somewhere. I had grown up in a world of theater. That was my ideal, really, in life, was to be a playwright or to be an actor and to be something great in the theater. And radio came to me purely out of accident, because of things having to do with the armed services. I wound up in a radio division and came out of the service interested in radio, not horrifyingly interested in it, but at least knowledgeable. And I'd always loved people like Vachel Lindsay and voice theater sort of things from the 30s, which were allied in my mind mostly with New York, a place far away from Fresno, California, where I grew up.
Penacook, Massachusetts.
Mohegan,
Delaware.
Mohawk,
Powhatan,
Alabama,
Cree,
Choctaw,
Tuscarora,
Susquehanna,
Iroquois,
Penacook,
Mohawk,
Powhatan,
Delaware,
Susquehanna,
Iroquois,
Chickasaw,
Sauk, Sanzark, Shawnee,
Arapaho, Arapaho,
Crow, Oto, Iowa,
Menominee,
Mandan, Mobile, Modoc,
Hopi, Apache, Nisqually, Shoshone,
Apache, Nisqually, Shoshone,
Shoshone,
Apache, Nisqually,
Shoshone,
Shoshone,
Apache,
Nisqually,
Shoshone,
Shoshone,
Apache,
Nisqually,
Shoshone,
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 Apache,
Shoshone,
Apache,
Shoshone,
Apache,
Shoshone.
What kind of characters did you play in the early days of the Firesign Theater?
At first, I think I was envisioned as the straight guy. I was the youngest guy. I was an actor. I was an announcer on the radio. I was from the country. I'm sort of country boy from Central California. And I, in the early days with the Firesign Theater, I would get all the parts where a guy would talk like this, you know, take acid or something. And spectacular and spooky things would happen to him. And on the very first album, on Waiting for the Electrician, the part I play, who's just called P, for what reason could that be, is, in fact, that kind of character.
I'm not afraid of justice. I know these bars are here for a good reason. Prisons are for the guilty.
String him up.
Anybody got any string?
He's just like the kid.
No, 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 don't you guys see? The system is here for your protection. I'm not afraid. All I want is a chance to clear my name. Look, we live and operate under the due process of law. The innocent have nothing to fear. Only the guilty will suffer.
Lynch him!
Anybody got any lynch?
He even looks like the kid.
Look, look, it's this simple. I'll get a hearing and a trial. I'm willing to place my fate and faith in the hands of justice.
Just burn the kid.
Mother? Mama? Mama, I'll be good. Mama, I will. Mama, I'll be good. Mama, I just want to get out of here.
This is sort of about Phil Austin. He suffers from the madness. Puts things in the ground. Leaves behind the moments of habitation, making a map of the farm, showing where things grow, growing things where the weeds grow. There are no weeds. They suffer from the madness. Take something with you into the wilderness, a door, a sack of grain, a moment's hesitation, a lesson. Rabbit trails lead to water. The secret traps and ropes hold you up. And hear the barking of dogs, and carry a forked stick, and head north, and show them the door. The wilderness, the tracks, the water.
Now, Phil, I guess you're probably best known as the voice of one of the best-known Firesign Theater characters.
Yes, that's right, Chuck. Nick Danger, Third Eye.
Yeah, so much so that he's, let's see, Nick's been in at least one video and three albums so far.
Yeah, it's a long and wacky career for Nick. He didn't ever expect to actually be in show business. He thought he'd spend his days pretty much face down on a floor somewhere.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's been a real thrill for him. I talk to him all the time.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I would hope so, anyway. How did that character, what's the genesis of Nick Danger? Because he has been such a popular part of the Firesign Theater world.
We needed something thousands of years ago when we were writing our second album. We need something to fill out the second side of it, and we sort of just launched into an idea that we would do some kind of parody of 40s and 50s detectives books and movies. And we particularly wanted to do something that was evocative of Raymond Chandler, and that's pretty much where Nick Danger came from. I forget who exactly, how the name came up or anything, but I do remember that all four of us were together at the same time, sitting in front of a roaring fire when it suddenly erupted. So, I mean, when Nick Danger suddenly erupted, the fire remained fairly calm.
One hopes, yes.
Yep.
Out of the roaring fire, into the smog, yes.
Nick Danger, one of the most mysterious of fictional gumshoes, has been thought for years to be solely the invention of the writer Lem Pozzo, who began writing detective thrillers as a veteran G.I. Bill writing student just after World War II.
Pozzo had previously been a clerk and a cook on duty in the South Pacific and had briefly seen combat on Guam. His most popular Nick Danger books are four, the first of which, Cut 'Em Off at the Past, from 1949, has three times been adapted for film, most recently the critically acclaimed 1993 French film La Vie en Merde. It is as well a popular comedy album by the equally mysterious Firesign Theater. The second is The Three Faces of Al, 1953, a psychological thriller of multiple identity and opium. And the third, Danger in Dreamland, 1955, in which Nick takes on multiple murders in Tinseltown. And finally, Down Under Danger, 1963, which was lifted heavily from popular apocalyptic visions of the time. Lem Pozzo always said he made the character of Nick Danger up out of the whole cloth, but recent evidence I have cited in my book, Danger Revealed, puts forth the probable truth, that there was indeed a real Nick Danger, a small-time, local Hollywood detective from whom Pozzo stole not only stories, but a complete identity. It's interesting to note that this real Nick Danger has a history that sounds as if it had been fabricated by Pozzo himself, who was never known to stick to a fact he couldn't color a bit more brightly. In any event, Nicholas Dangeropoulos, popularly known as Nick Danger, was born into a family of Greek sheepherders in Fresno, California, despite reports in the popular press in later years, evidently of his own making, that he was raised by a wealthy Maine industrialist named Jonas Acme. Acme, by the way, invented the name Acme and made a fortune putting it on commodities of all kinds. The simple peasants whom Danger falsely believed to be his parents, Golda and Heinz Krumhunger of Fryant, California, were not even Greeks, although they thought they were, and they were paid handsomely to keep him in the dark as to his real ancestry. Danger spent his youth happily chasing ewes in the hills of the Sierra Nevada and singing the popular songs of the era in the Basque hotels of Nevada and Central California. He was best known for the traditional Mi Corazón Mi Huevo. Unknown to him, he was in fact the son of King Creosote of Thebes, the king of poles and wire as he was known. His royal father abandoned him at birth for reasons best known to himself, and another son, Porky, deemed more suitable to rule, was raised in his place. Porky Dangeropoulos is now a prince and owns a yacht the size of Rhode Island and wears a bikini and is fat and covered with hair and has a perpetual tan and is surrounded by young babes from the former Yugoslavia, eager for a good time and some hard currency with which to support their secret children. For Danger, life was considerably different. He attended schools in Fresno, graduating from Mental High School, and quickly dropped out of college. After a stint in the Army, in the secret military police, by the way, he says others enlisted, he stinted, and where on Guam he presumably first met Lem Pozzo, he found himself rootless in Los Angeles, or eyeless in Gaza, as his screenwriter friend Algis Isherwood once said. He was armed and highly trained in the arts of tracking, sabotage, deception, and deceit. So he joined the Bay City Police Department, but was forced out in a scandal of epic proportions. It was, in fact, said that the chesty stripper involved, Hale Stone, was of epic proportions herself. A long-running feud with the men promoted above him, especially Chief Ray Chandler and Lieutenant, later District Attorney Alvin Bradshaw, took his career to the depths. His only recourse was to become a private eye and continue, as he said to me once, bashing his thick head against a brick wall. Today, Danger is said to be retired and very old, but alive, which is more than could be said for Pozzo, who died miserably in 1980. His real adventures as a private dick are being chronicled by his biographer in a series of hard-bitten stories that have attained much popular, though not literary, note. It's an interesting sidelight that Danger tried without success to sue Pozzo to establish his identity several times, but to no avail. Pozzo insisted until the end that Danger did not really even exist, except in his, Pozzo's, imagination. And this argument won the day in several sensational court cases in which the real Danger was not even allowed into the courtroom.
He poured another jigger into my cup. Darkness had fallen over Hollywood, although the temperature seemed higher than when the sun was up. Cicadas buzzed lazily among the orange blossoms in his little courtyard. Now this Pheasanton was a fool for a little dame who lived in a log cabin with her father and some goats up where Bronson Canyon is now. Her name was Esther Quirt-Uiop. I stopped him. The daughter of Edwin Quirt-Uiop, the inventor of the typewriter? The very same, he nodded. About the time Pheasanton showed up on the scene, old Ed passed away in his sleep, and so here was little Esther, as alone as you could be in a national forest that was only a few blocks from Hollywood Boulevard. And like I say, this guy Pheasanton was as rich as that Greek that invented the stuff they coat telephone poles with. You mean Creosote, King of Thebes, I said. Yeah, that's the guy. Interesting note here, Pheasanton was the guy that felled all those 300-footers up on the old Mulholland Crest Trail. Trees that tall up on Mulholland? I must have sounded incredulous. No, glowered the old man. Telephone poles, they were famous. The British used to come through and mark them as masts for their tall ships, but never got around to cutting them. Why not? I asked. Who cares? They were busy. I don't know. Anyway, here's Pheasanton sitting on top of the profits of all that and willing to let little Esther be the co-beneficiary, so to speak, and that's when it happened. He stopped and peered at me closely. What? I asked. What happened? My salad days, he spoke with some triumph. That's what happened. That's what we're talking about, isn't it? I had to admit that it was. I smiled politely and made little sharpening motions with the tip of my pencil. He leaned forward suddenly, and his old oak swivel chair squealed in protest. He softly placed his old feet in their brogans flat on the floor, but did not rise. He leaned forward and fixed me with his eyes. You see, Esther Quirt Uiop was one of the two women in my life that I have loved deeply. Esther was like a kind of wood nymph or sprite, you know. She would flit through the autumnal meadows, backlit with the glowing light of the sun or those huge lights they use when they make movies. I forget what you call them. Anyway, she was just beautiful. Porky Samuelson, the picture director, used to say that Esther was like a metaphor in bloom. No kidding. Nope. No kidding. She was what was, in those primitive days, often called a big blonde bombshell. That is, she was something to look at.
See a famous scientist reduced to a wimp by his wife. By virtue of the lack of need for atomic bombs. Atomic Wimp, this fall. Chapter 1, the Edmund Teller story.
Tell her, Edmund. Atomic Wimp.
But dear, I made 6 bombs before dinner. Get out of this house, Turkey. I know what you've been doing.
Only atomic thing about you is your breath.
Get out of here.
You are beautiful, Una.
Oh, for God's sake.
We've been talking about 4 or 5 crazy guys of the Fire Sign Theater. Phil Proctor and Peter Bergman, David Osman and Phil Austin. Phil, who's the 5th crazy guy?
4 or 5 crazy guys is a ancient joke with Fire Sign Theater that has to do, I think, mostly with the fact that there were so many of us, there are so many of us, that it doesn't matter if there's 4 or 5. 4 people all talking at once is just as bad as 5 people all talking at once. And you don't know that unless you're in something called a comedy group, which is the most talkative art form God ever even imagined. And I'm sure God did not imagine it while he had 4 other people all talking at once. So it's like probably the 5th guy is God, and he prevails upon us every once in a while to all shut up so that he will talk. And in his divine wisdom, there we are doing what he wanted us to do, which was be stupid on the radio for the most part. When you're all talking at once, it's like spirits can just walk in off the street and start, you know, just talking through your head. So after a while, whatever seemed to be a thread through what we were all talking about at once was the 5th guy, obviously. That was him. He was the smart one.
When Peter passed away from leukemia, you know, it's like God closes one door and then he slams another one in your face.
In this case, he opens a window. It's opens nothing a window.
Yeah,
through.
You fall out of it, you know. Yeah.
I turned on the radio after a while, but the only thing on it was either people yelling at each other about Mexicans or music that sounded like it would be best enjoyed by refrigerators and toasters. I figured there was no place on it for me and my old friend and hoped he'd forget about what he'd asked me to do. And then suddenly, the world went dark, as if there had been an eclipse of the sun. The little light left was spooky. Anything that cast a pinhole of light was in the shape of the obscured sun. From the radio, I heard the clop-clop of horses' hooves on cobblestones and the cry of ancient rooks and a deep-voiced narrator talking something about Charlemagne. Then there was an ad for beaver hats and then one for clabbered milk. The next thing I knew, another guy with a deep voice came on and announced that the old detective was dead.
It had been night. It had been dark night. Silver birds had flown through the night. Their wingtips had brushed me. Their wingtips had brushed my face. Now it was dawn. Now I knew it was dawn. It was dawn. It was dawning. It was getting darker. It was getting darker. It was getting darker where it was night. It was getting darker where it was night. I knew it was dawning. I was sitting on the diesel engine. My back was warm from the diesel engine. My back was warm from the locomotive. I was the keeper of the locomotive. It was dawn. It was dawning. I was yawning. It was an all-night job. It was an all-night job in the train yards. It was by the highway. It was over by the highway. It was over by the Highway 99. It was underneath the sign that said Highway 99. It was underneath the Highway 99 sign. Anyway, the sun came up. The sun was coming up. It was getting higher in the sky. The sky was turning golden. It was the golden sky. It was the pearl sky. It was our father, the sun. It was the golden sky. It was his pearl sky. Now those birds, they flew through the dawn. It was like fish leaping in the high country. It was like trout going about their business in the morning. It was like rainbow trout leaping in the morning. It was rainbow trout leaping through the dawn. It was the scales of our brother the fish. He came leaping through the dawn. He had come back to us safe. He had been away from us. He had come back to us. He had come back to us to make us happy. It was happy. It was like birds flying in the dawn. I was sitting on the locomotive. I had my feet and my boots hooked in the guardrail. I was a young man that morning. I was taking the locomotive to its shed. It had been night. It had been a short run. It had been a short run from Kalinga. It had been a short run from Chowchilla. It had been a short run from Tulare. It had been a short run from Dinuba. It was making me happy. I have been remembering it ever since. I have been trying to say it ever since. Now I have said it again. Now I am finished.
If you can't laugh at it, it's got you under its control, says Austin. When you can laugh at something, then you're free.